The fourth year. He did not speak a word to Dumbledore for the duration of the summer, whilst Black's failure to make any further attempts on Potter's life appeared to suggest that the headmaster, damn it, might well have been right, a cautious note of doubt still remained in Severus's mind. Even had it not, Severus would never have admitted as such. He still had his pride. The nightmares of Lupin tailed off with his resignation and departure, a small enough victory to which Severus clung. He continued to dream, however, strange and unsettling dreams in which Lily shifted into Potter and back again, nebulous visions in which the two of them merged and bled into one being. Severus did not quite know what to make of them, except that they left him uneasy. Halfway through the holidays, Minerva broke through his self-imposed isolation and visited for tea. They spoke largely of inconsequential matters, and, to his surprise, Severus found that he rather enjoyed himself. When she made a particularly barbed comment about the ministry towards the end, he actually smiled. She smiled back, taking a sip of her tea, and then regarded him silently for a moment.
"It's good to see your spirits have lifted," she said. "You have been rather quiet of late. Reserved."
Severus raised an eyebrow.
"And as my natural state is to be the life of the party, this clearly marks a momentous change."
Minerva's lips quirked at the corners.
"Well, no," she said, "but it has been notable, more so than usual."
Severus dropped his gaze to the teacups.
"I hope you'll forgive me remarking on it, but sometimes I worry about you."
"You needn't."
"Be that as it may, I do."
She paused for a moment, as though giving time for the words to sink in, and stirred her tea.
"I would never presume to ask what has passed between you and the headmaster to cause such a rift."
"Good," Severus said, looking straight at her, "because I'd never tell you."
"I know," Minerva said, not unkindly. "And I am certain that whatever it was, you have good cause for your anger. Albus can be quite a handful if he chooses to be."
It must have been the sheer unexpectedness of that acknowledgement which froze Severus's tongue. He could find no other reason for why he had not yet shown her the door.
"It is not my place to intrude," Minerva said, "but I do hate to see you struggle so, and do with it what you will, but if you'll listen to the words of an old woman, whatever you're fighting so hard against, can you change it? Because if not, it may be easier to try and accept it."
Severus opened his mouth, although he had no idea what he planned to say, but she waved him off before he could speak.
"No," she said, "I don't want an answer. It is a question only you can ask yourself."
She rose to her feet.
"I have imposed on you long enough for one afternoon. I shall see myself out."
He dismissed her words in the first instance, but on the day that the dark mark blazed across the headlines of the Daily Prophet, he sat by the lake and thought of Lily and Potter, of the thankless task he had been given. He did not move for long hours, did not move even when Dumbledore walked up and came to stand by his side.
"There is a storm coming," Dumbledore said.
Severus looked out on the lake, at its smooth, placid waters, only the faintest of ripples chasing over their surface beneath the breeze. He had not asked to take responsibility for Potter's life. He carried it, nevertheless.
"Yes," he said.
Like all storms, this one brewed quietly. Well, as quietly as was possible, when a school of this size prepared for receiving two foreign delegations, and when one carried the onerous duty of being a head of house. The fact that the new DADA teacher was an ex-Auror who'd prefer to see him in Azkaban did not exactly help matters, but, frankly, anyone was an improvement on Lupin. Severus would never in a million years come to call Moody friend, but at least with him, what you saw was what you got. Where others mocked the man's paranoia, Severus could grasp it entirely. Like him, Moody was above all else a survivor, and that alone made him deserving of a certain kind of respect. It also made it much easier not to take any barbs personally. So, when Moody came to his office on the first day of term, Malfoy in tow, Severus let the sly references to his past bounce off him like water off of a duck until the man had had his full. Right now, he was far more concerned with Draco's continued lack of subtlety.
"I confess to finding myself very disappointed in you, Mr. Malfoy," he said once the door had shut behind Moody. "Attacking Potter, of all people, in broad daylight? Have I not taught you better than that?
He insulted my mother.
And your urge to defend her is most admirable, I'm sure. But to do so in plain sight of teachers, to act rashly, on impulse, does your house, my house, a disservice. Firing off a hex the moment it springs to mind takes neither cunning nor guile. Any Gryffindor could do it. In fact, they frequently do. Have you, perchance, been missorted, Mr. Malfoy?"
Draco's face turned ashen.
"No."
"Then prove it," Severus said. He stalked around the side of his desk and came to a halt just beside the boy, leaning in. "I expect better from you, and I know you can deliver it. Act like the Slytherin you are, and we shan't have a problem."
Draco's bottom lip quivered.
"This isn't fair," he muttered. "You can't just imply I'm like... If my father hears..." "Your father," Severus said, "would be appalled at your behavior, and you know it. So by all means, tell him about it. It is your choice. But do not expect me to varnish the truth on your behalf."
Judging by the way the boy's shoulders tightened, perhaps that had been a bit harsh, if, given Draco's propensities, unfortunately necessary. Severus withdrew, moving over to his desk, and leaned back against it.
"If, however," he said more softly, "you choose not to tell him, then I see no pressing reason to inform him of your little lapse either. The matter can stay entirely between us. After all, you are still learning. Certain allowances have to be made."
He could see the fight play out on the boy's face before he cautiously looked up. Then,
He turned me into a ferret.
Severus's eyebrows shot up in astonishment.
"Potter?"
"No, Moody." Severus tilted his head.
"Did he?"
His respect for Moody had just dropped a significant notch. There were some lines which simply ought not to be crossed.
"In that case, Mr. Malfoy, I can assure you that I will take this matter to the headmaster and protest it to the fullest extent. And should you ever find yourself transfigured by a teacher again, you will come directly to me so that I can handle it, yes?"
"Yes," Draco said, although the relief in his voice was still tempered by fear. "He doesn't seem to like you very much, sir."
"No," Severus agreed with a slow smile, "but I have it on good authority that he was in Gryffindor, and, unlike them, I know how to fight dirty. Run along now, and try to do better next time, hmm?"
"Yes," Draco said. "Thank you, sir." In truth, Severus rather hoped he'd not have occasion to fight Moody ever. The man might be mad, but he would make a formidable opponent, and any true Slytherin knew how to stack probabilities and risks, knew his own limits and when it was wisest to quit. But Draco hardly needed to know that. Draco did not do better. In fact, he did significantly worse. Less than 3 weeks later, whilst Severus was walking through the courtyard, the boy barreled straight into him as though hell itself was hard on his heels. He was trembling so hard that his teeth chattered wildly, his face tear-streaked, his robes covered in snot. Between the sobs, hiccoughs, and broken-off stammers, Severus could not hear one word. In the end, he had to shake Draco hard by the shoulders to force him into some semblance of coherency.
"Calm yourself," he said,
and any harshness in his tone was solely due to alarm.
"Take a deep breath first, and then tell me what happened."
But Draco did not listen. He had already grabbed Severus's hand and was tugging him frantically in the direction of one of the older greenhouses, which had long since fallen out of use. He ducked into the gap between its grimy glass walls and the solid foundations of the castle, and now Severus knew where they were headed. Just around the corner lay a familiar stone alcove, a much-favored trysting spot for students, shielded both by the greenhouse and the bushes which grew at its entrance. 2 feet away from it, Draco stopped and spun around.
"You have to help me," he gasped. "I didn't mean..."
Severus's alarm grew. He pushed past the boy, ducking through the bushes, and promptly ground to a halt. But not for long. In the next instant, he was on his knees beside Potter, where he lay with wide-open, glassy eyes.
"He's not..." Draco stammered behind him. "Please, don't say he's..."
Severus dropped his hand. Unsurprisingly, there was no pulse.
"Oh, God," Draco sobbed. "Oh, God, I'm a murderer. They'll send me to Azkaban. They'll have me..."
"Silence," Severus said. He rose to his feet and turned, fixing the boy with a stare. "How," he said very slowly, "did this happen?" Draco hiccoughed, swallowed, then hiccoughed again.
"It was an accident."
"An accident?"
"Yes. No. I mean, oh, God, this is all my fault."
And the sobbing returned with a vengeance. They would get nowhere like this, and Severus had not the patience to wait until the boy had cried himself out. He rifled through his robes for the calming draught he usually carried and tipped it down Draco's throat. Draco sputtered, then swayed. Severus guided him down until he sat with his back to the wall, hugging his knees to his chest. The tears continued to flow, but more quietly now, reduced to an intensity which would at least allow the boy to speak.
"Let's try again," Severus said. "Tell me what happened from the beginning, in detail." "It really was an accident. I didn't plan for any of this."
"You expect me to believe that you and Potter just so happened to run into each other here, out of all the possible locations in Hogwarts?"
"I swear, I didn't think he'd be here either. I came to spy on, you know."
Severus momentarily closed his eyes. A murderer and a voyeur. Marvelous.
"But instead, there was Potter sitting there, sulking. So I thought about what you said about not starting fights where teachers could see."
A muscle near Severus's eye twitched sharply.
"And I just goaded him a little at first. The usual. He got all wound up and told me to fuck off and get my ferret face out of his space, and then I..."
"Yes?"
"I didn't really think," Draco said, his breath hitching. "It wasn't meant to. I just thought about how we've been covering the unforgivables in DADA, see? How Moody puts us all under Imperius, and how stupid Potter looked, and how he jumped up on the table quicker than anyone else, and I..."
Severus stared, in mixed horror and amazement.
"It was only meant for a laugh."
"A laugh," Severus said, frozen in perfect stillness. "You cast Imperio. For a laugh."
"I only meant to scare him. I didn't even think it would work. Father constantly goes on about how difficult it is to master dark..."
"I'll pretend not to have heard that."
"Oh, like you didn't know already. He's told me all about how you two used to..."
"I'll pretend not to have heard that either," Severus said more sharply. "So, you cast it. And then? Where was the joke?"
I told him to...
"Yes?"
Draco's next words were lost in a mumble. Severus, quite at the end of his tether, grabbed him by the shoulders and pulled him up.
"You told him to what?"
Draco's eyes twisted shut.
"Suck my cock."
"Of course. Of bloody course. He should have seen that one coming, miles away.
But then," Draco continued all in a rush, "he actually started to do it, and I freaked the fuck out. Thank heavens for small mercies," Severus thought. "So I pushed him away, and he hit his head on the wall, and then he started shaking and seizing. So I freaked out more and ran to get help, and now he's dead, and I'm going to be sent to Azkaban, and Mother's going to be so upset, and I never meant for this to..."
A fresh wave of sobs, strong enough to break through the potion, curtailed the rest of his sentence. Severus watched him cry for a minute, glancing back over at Potter, then back to Draco. He could not even muster an appropriate level of rage, already ruminating on the dangers which Potter's surprising susceptibility to Imperius presented for the future. If even Draco had managed to compel him through what was essentially equated to sheer force of wishful thinking.
"By all rights," he said, taking a step back and lifting his wand, "I should inform you at length about what a simpering, idiotic dimwit you truly are, Mr. Malfoy. But, as it turns out, you're in luck. Stupefy."
He obliviated Draco whilst he was still unconscious, thus buying himself time to dispose of Potter's body somewhere safe. He could not waste precious hours dealing with overwrought colleagues and students alike, as would surely occur if he brought the corpse to the infirmary. He had research to do. Halfway through the night, Dumbledore popped his head through the flue to inform him that Potter had gone missing.
"I know," Severus said, turning a page. "I am attending to it."
Dumbledore took one look at the tomes and reams of old parchment spread across every surface of Severus's living room and vanished without another word. For once, Severus was glad of his insistence on not knowing. At least half of the books on his table were highly illegal, the other half at least marginally so. Throughout most of the year they slumbered, quietly, in the hidden cavern beneath his four-poster. He preferred to ignore their existence entirely, in spite of how useful they were. Merely touching them sent shivers and chills up his spine, a heavy, sick longing roiling beneath the surface of his skin. The one he was currently reading was written in blood. It nauseated him as much as it compelled him. Few texts on the dark arts were composed without added enticements woven into their pages, their bindings, their lines. To read them at all was unquestionably dangerous, but not more so than a potter whose will bent like blades of grass in a breeze. Severus could not allow that to happen. He finally found the reference, ironically enough, in one of the less dubious scrolls. It was so old that magic alone held the paper together, one of the rarities he had scavenged years ago from the Room of Requirement. The language itself was equally obscure, so brief and oblique that unless one fully grasped the twain concepts which underpinned it, one could easily have read past it. It did, however, explicitly state the price that had to be paid. And although some part deep inside him recoiled instinctively, Severus already knew that he would pay it.
"Detention!"
"What?" Potter's eyes blazed with fury behind those ridiculous glasses. "But I didn't do anything."
"You whispered when I expressly told you to work quietly.
I did not—"
"Silence! One more word from your lips, Mr. Potter," he loomed over the boy, one hand poised on his desk, "and it shall be a week's worth of detention. My office, tonight, 8 p.m. sharp."
Potter glared at him for the remainder of the lesson, but Severus ignored him. As soon as class was dismissed, he fled to his quarters, where he paced the length of his living room, full of nervous tension. Snape watched him for several long minutes, frowning. Then,
"You still will not tell me what you intend to do?"
"No,"
Severus said, and continued to pace. "You will find out soon enough, once I've achieved it."
"Because," Severus said, setting his book on the table, "you seem highly strong, even for me.
Perhaps if you only cared to share the burden."
Severus stopped abruptly and swiveled toward him with a glare.
"No." "Why not?"
"Because," Severus said, "you may attempt to talk me out of it, knowing you." Snape's frown deepened.
"If that is so, then it may be wisest to—"
"No!" Severus slammed his hand on the table, and it reverberated beneath him.
"It is crucial. It is essential. I am committed to this, and I cannot afford to have you doubting me every step of the way. As a matter of fact, this would be a damn sight easier without your prying and nagging, so do me a favor and get the hell away from me. Go to the bedroom, take a nap, do a crossword. I don't care."
"Fuck
you,
Snape said, enunciating each word very clearly. But he disappeared into the bedroom regardless, even if he muttered about split psyches and muggle analysts having a field day on his way. Potter eyed him with suspicion from the moment that Severus swept them past the usual classroom in which detention took place and headed up the stairs instead. By the time they were traversing Hogwarts' dark, silent grounds, he was shooting looks at Severus every other second. "Where are we going?" he asked for the third time. Severus had ignored the first two inquiries altogether, but it did not seem sensible to do it again. He couldn't have the boy running off before he had started.
"I have need of certain ingredients which can only be harvested at night."
"Right," Potter said, sounding like he didn't believe the lie for 1 minute. He cast a skittish glance back at the castle.
"Ingredients," Severus continued in his most icy tone, "which, alas, can only be collected by a virgin."
That shut him up for a good while. Long enough to get them to the clearing Severus had decided was distant enough from the castle to prevent unexpected disruptions. He watched Potter's eyes dart about the ground in confusion for a moment, reflecting on how he truly possessed not an ounce of self-preservation. Then Severus disarmed him with a wordless spell. Well, perhaps not an ounce, but a dram, because at the loss of his wand, Potter immediately whirled about and began to back away.
"What are you doing?" he said, voice high-pitched and thready.
Severus advanced on him, and Potter's pace quickened. He stumbled over a root and fell back against a tree.
"I have no intention of harming you," Severus said.
Potter looked up at him, eyes wide with fear or with anger.
"Oh, really?" he said. "Fuck you. Fuck you. I knew it all along. This is why my scar has been hurting again. You're trying to bring him back to life. So, what, are you going to kill me now, or just hand me to him on a platter?"
Potter's scar? Hurting? Interesting. But now was not the time. Later. Later. Severus lifted his wand.
"Imperio."
He had forgotten. It had been years since he had last used the spell. Well over a decade. Over a decade, and now that he threw his whole force into the casting, it burst through him like starlight, like fire. It danced through his blood, enfolding him in the most brilliant of songs, each note pitch perfect and pure. Absolute power. Control. For a moment, as Potter's eyes grew glassy below him, Severus swayed, drunk with it, dizzy. He could do anything, anything to the boy. He could crush him, break him, shape him to his every wish, his every will. He could...
No.
That was not what he was here for. He could not, would not abandon his purpose. He clung to it, desperately, and thrust himself headfirst into the boy's mind. From a distance, he heard Potter screaming, but he did not care. He dove in and flung open all the doors, until he was awash in a flood of fast-spinning colors. Then he found all the trapdoors, too, and burst through them, digging deeper, down, down into the stillness. There, he twisted and pulled, gathering gossamer threads and shaping them into a knot, but delicately, only enough for his purpose. There, he left a part of himself, weaving it into the space between thoughts, as though it was almost not there at all. It hurt coming back to himself, dropping both spells. It clearly hurt Potter, too, because he groaned, shuddering weakly where he lay on the ground.
"What?" Potter gasped. "What have you done?"
Staring down at him, Severus did not need to wonder if he'd been successful. He could feel the cracks in the walls of his defenses like a gaping hole, the fissures through which Potter, only Potter, would forever be able to slip through from this point onwards. It did not matter. Potter was no Legilimens. Chances were, he never would be.
"Obliviate," Severus said.
Although he did not require confirmation, he received it nevertheless, carried on students' hushed whispers through the corridors.
"Have you heard?" And, "He's resistant to Imperius," and stopped himself from jumping and smashed straight into the desk.
Excellent. That left only one loose end to tie up from the whole Draco-prompted affair, one which he'd much prefer not to tie up at all, but which he could not, in good conscience, simply let slide. By the time he had gathered the Slytherins, 4th through 7th years, in one of the larger classrooms on the first floor, he would have given a limb to be anywhere else, any place at all. He did not allow it to show, however, keeping his features impassive and his back straight as he watched them settle down. It did not take long until they were eyeing him with curiosity, and he played on the tension, surveying them coolly for several minutes as he walked the breadth of the classroom with slow, measured steps. Only when they were regarding him with rapt attention did he come to a halt, taking care to swivel just sharply enough for his robes to flare outwards. It never hurt to put on a show.
"No doubt you are wondering why I've summoned you here," he said, "or, for that matter, why your younger housemates are not present."
He paused and took another couple of deliberate steps.
"You are here because it has recently, much to my distaste, I can assure you, come to my attention that each and every one of you is about to enter, or, in many cases, has entered a fair while ago," a glance at the 6th and 7th years, "that particular phase of your life in which hormones are apt to warp every last ounce of your reason."
A few of the younger students tittered, whereas the older ones looked mostly exasperated or affronted. One rolled his eyes.
"Silence," Severus said.
He leaned forward, fingertips poised on the surface of his desk.
"Let me be perfectly clear. I care not one whit for whatever hopeless romantic entanglements you are bound to engage in over the coming years. Nor do I care about whether they lack romance entirely. This lecture's purpose is not to inform you about," his lips curled, "the birds and the bees."
Now, they simply looked confused.
"There is only one matter I intend to discuss with you," Severus said, straightening and flicking his wand at the blackboard.
A single word appeared in large white letters. Consent.
"I realize," Severus said, whilst they were still busy staring, "that this may be a novel concept to many of you. Others may feel that it should not apply to members of this house. You are wrong. If I ever catch word that one of you has engaged a fellow student, whatever their house, in sexual acts against their will, I shall personally see to it that the person in question is expelled."
He paused long enough to take in their frowns and tense faces.
"This includes all use of love or lust potions, and any," his eyes flicked to Draco, who paled, "coercive spells. It is not cunning to induce unnatural attraction by brewing a draught. In fact, it is such a blatantly obvious option that it should be beneath you all. Likewise, if your greatest ambition is to rely on flicking your wand every time you seek company, you possess no true ambition at all. To put it quite simply, no means no."
Halfway through the sentence, he became aware of the door opening in his peripheral vision. Profoundly irritated and equally uncomfortable, he turned towards it and glared at the intruder. Minerva stared back at him, mouth slightly open. Severus resisted the ridiculous urge to squirm and forcibly willed down the heat which threatened to rise to his cheeks.
"Yes,"
he said. Minerva blinked. "Pardon me," she said. "I was under the impression that this classroom was vacant." Severus scowled.
"Evidently, it is not."
"Well," Minerva said, the beginnings of a smile playing over her lips, "seeing as how no means no." And she closed the door. Thoroughly thrown off balance, Severus straightened his robes and turned back to the class.
"Where was I?"
"Love potions aren't cunning," Pansy Parkinson muttered, sounding less than pleased.
"Quite," Severus said. "Now, if any of you should have questions..."
Across the room, 30 hands instantly shot into the air. Inwardly cursing, Severus steeled himself against query after query about morally gray territory, projecting an air of confidence when surely he was the least qualified person on Earth to answer any of them. If only he were standing in front of a bunch of Gryffindors. Or, even better, Hufflepuffs. At least the Goblet of Fire had the good sense to choose a Hufflepuff over one of his Slytherins. Severus, who had quite enough on his plate between Longbottom's renewed efforts to melt Potter into an early grave and Karkaroff's unfortunate presence, breathed a sigh of relief as Diggory smiled modestly and disappeared from the hall. And then the flames shifted to red, and his relief turned to horror, because before Dumbledore caught the paper, before he read out the name, he knew what it would be. That reckless, glory-hungry fool. Here Severus was, bending over backwards, forced to use magic he'd forsaken for reasons, risking the very integrity of his mind and cracking himself wide open, all in order to protect Potter's life, only for the child to go and throw himself into danger's jaws with conscious intent, against everyone's explicit advice. In the heat of the moment, even acceptance failed to temper his fury.
"There is an alternative, of course," he said to Dumbledore, after everyone had duly aired their protest and walked off, leaving them, briefly, alone.
"I know," Dumbledore said, "but I am not certain it is wise."
"Potter may believe he is up to the task, but—"
"Harry did not enter his name into the goblet. Of this much I am sure."
"It would not be the first time that Potter has courted death because he's desperate for fame," Severus narrowed his eyes, "just like his father."
Dumbledore sighed.
"I find it remarkable how someone who has spent as much time as you watching over the boy could still cling to the notion that he is anything remotely like James, especially someone as keenly perceptive as you. Harry does not seek fame. He fairly loathes it, I suspect. If you took the time to speak to him—"
"I have," Severus said. "He is arrogant, disrespectful, and insubordinate."
"And is that his natural state, or because you treat him as though it is so?"
"If not Potter," Severus said, quite through with the topic, "then who, pray tell, would have entered his name?"
"Ah," Dumbledore said, "now that is the real question, is it not? I fear I cannot answer it either, but whoever it was, they want Harry in a contest which poses a great deal of risk to his health and well-being. This alone is cause for concern, wouldn't you agree? At the same time, I fear that were you to go back and stand guard over the goblet, we might lose our only chance of determining what their true motives may be. I suspect they are far from straightforward, but may well be the key."
Severus's blood tingled with unease.
"Potter's scar has been hurting," he said, after a moment's deliberation.
Dumbledore raised an eyebrow.
"Yes, I have received similar reports already."
"From whom?"
But Dumbledore did not answer.
"Interesting," he said instead, watching Severus shrewdly, "that you should be aware of it."
Severus met his gaze evenly, and although he knew it to be pointless paranoia, threw every last inch of his will against the cracks in his wall.
"Not keen on fame, pah! Potter couldn't seem to scramble out of his class fast enough less than 2 weeks later, clearly eager to leave the moment that Creevy Boy mentioned the word photography. He even went so far as to seek adulation from Weasley, who, for once in his life, appeared to be acting as though he possessed the vestiges of a brain and blanked Potter entirely. The article in The Prophet the following day only proved it, Potter milking the public perception of his sad, lost orphan tale for all he was worth. And if Rita Skeeter had a tendency to sometimes veer slightly off the truth, well, that didn't mean anything. Merely that, this time, far less effort had been required of her.
After all, Potter's little duel with Draco prior to class demonstrated one thing incontrovertibly. He thrived on being the center of attention. Severus selected pickled rat's brains for detention very deliberately, with a dual purpose in mind: to subtly cheer Weasley on in continuing to make use of his, and to prompt Potter to perhaps think a little on why he appeared to possess none whatsoever. As teaching strategies went, it was likely to fail, but it amused Severus nonetheless. Something, somewhere, had gone horribly wrong, and it had been when some imbecile decided to pick dragons for the first task. Half-collapsed over the desk in his quarters, Severus wanted nothing so much as to screw his eyes shut and ignore the certain doom that was playing out right before him, but he could not, for the life of him, look away. What a momentously fucked-up train wreck he'd gotten himself into.
"This is all your fault," snapped Snape across the room. "If you hadn't missed the mark with your spell and cut the damn thing loose..."
"Oh, really?" shouted Snape number 3. Or was it 4? "If you'd got it right the first time around, we wouldn't be in this mess in the first place."
"And if you," interjected another, "hadn't turned up at precisely the wrong moment and got in my way..."
"No, that was him," a finger went pointing, "not me. Don't bring me into this. I am completely blameless."
"Because it was such a fantastic idea to get yourself discovered by Skeeter, was it? You're confusing me again. That preposterous fuck-up was entirely down to him. And I would never have turned up at the wrong time if it hadn't been for that," said Snape number.
Oh, fucking hell. Severus had completely lost count.
"Mind you, you'll both do it, not too long from now. And entangle ourselves hopelessly, as you did, not a chance in hell."
"This doesn't even make sense," said another Snape, crossing his arms. At least 3 others followed suit. "The very fabric of space-time should have collapsed by now. None of us should be here. What a profoundly helpful perspective! Why, if it wasn't for your incisive reasoning, this is your fault. No, it's yours. Could somebody," interjected a Snape, who Severus strongly suspected belonged to the timeline they were in, "kindly inform me what the ever-loving fuck is going on here?"
A deafening cacophony of 10 Snapes shouting at once followed his inquiry. Severus slammed his hands on the table.
"Shut up!" he yelled into the chaos. "Shut up, all of you, or I swear I'm going to kill someone any bloody second now."
They all paused, turning to stare at him. Then,
"You'd only be killing yourself," said the 4th Snape from the left. "Which one are you, anyway?" said the one next to him.
Severus dropped his forehead to the table.
"I have a headache."
The fire in the hearth sputtered. A moment later, Dumbledore's head poked through it. All the Snapes, Severus included, swiveled toward him at once, fixing him with a combined glare.
"Oh dear," Dumbledore said, stroking his beard. "Perhaps I ought to have protested the use of dragons more strenuously than I did."
"You think?" they shouted in unison.
And although the headmaster was a Gryffindor, he was old enough to be wise. He instantly disappeared. How Severus resolved the first task of fuckery, he later couldn't have said. All he knew was that it involved some thoroughly convoluted arithmancy and many more confusing sketches, peppered with plenty of yelling and threats of bodily harm. A truer miracle there never had been. He spent the rest of the week in his darkened chambers, drugged up on pain potions and under constant cooling charms, suffering the fiercest headache in the history of the universe as 12, or maybe 13, sets of separate memories vied for their place inside his pathetically limited brain. November slid into December uneventfully, and for a month the most exciting thing to happen was Potter being blasted to death by one of Hagrid's misshapen crossbreeds. This one required some lateral thinking, as no literature existed on blast-ended scroots. The problem of a gaggle of girls trampling Potter into the ground whilst fighting over who was to claim him as their date for the Yule Ball was more easily solved. Severus simply took care to whip them into a frenzy before they ever got to the boy. Their claws did the rest. He did not look forward to Christmas. At all. This year, the seasonal decorations had grown more aggravating than ever, the corridors flanked by caterwauling suits of armor and damn fairy lights twinkling everywhere. How this presented anything but appalling lack of taste to their foreign visitors, Severus failed to grasp, but his opinion was soundly ignored at staff meetings. Even his intention to draw some small measure of enjoyment from the dreadful spectacle of the ball by terrorizing amorous students fell flat on the night, because Karkaroff stuck to him like a barnacle.
"You must have noticed it, Severus," Karkaroff said in a hushed voice, as they trailed past the bushes, "and if this goes where I believe that it will..."
Of course Severus had noticed. Hard as he tried, he had never been able to learn how to completely avoid looking at his own arm, and even if he had, he'd still have known the imprint there was changing. In the dead of the night, it sometimes seemed to crawl inside his skin, shifting as though it had almost, almost awoken. It unsettled him deeply, but revealing that to Karkaroff equaled suicide.
"Merely a trick of the light," Severus said. "A single shadow, and you imagine the worst. Myself, I don't see what there is to fuss about, Igor."
"Severus, you cannot pretend this isn't happening. It's been getting clearer and clearer for months. I'm becoming seriously concerned. I can't deny it."
"Then flee," Severus said sharply. "Flee. I will make your excuses. I, however, am remaining at Hogwarts."
If only the man would shut up. Severus refocused his attention on the movement behind the bushes, blasting several of them apart, but he could not even find delight in the embarrassed squeals of the students who raced past him. They only made him angrier.
10 points from Hufflepuff, Fawcett," he snarled, "and 10 points from Ravenclaw too, Stebbins."
To say that he was less than thrilled to glance up the path to see Potter and Weasley there, nosying about as usual with overly curious looks on their faces, would have been a vast understatement.
"And what are you two doing?"
"We're walking," Weasley said in a most insolent tone. "Not against the law, is it?"
"Keep walking, then," Severus said and brushed past them.
But his hopes of losing Karkaroff were in vain. All night he stuck to Severus like glue. He started keeping a diary of Potter's deaths, if only so he would have something to remind him, in darker moments, of how far he had come and what he'd achieved. Naturally, he keyed the text to his touch. Should it fall into the wrong hands, all they would see were boring accounts of potions' ingredients.
"Gored by a unicorn," he wrote early in January, when his mind slipped onto contemplating whether folktales were simply mistaken in insisting that unicorns only ever killed those already polluted, he stared at the page in outright horror for a second, and then swore to never, ever think such thoughts again.
Unfortunately, as luck would have it, the rest of the world appeared disinclined to allow him such oblivion. Severus avoided the staff room during peak times as a rule, preferring to rise early and get there before the chattering hordes in order to attend to paperwork. The messenger pigeons which delivered said paperwork to the teachers unfortunately flew directly into their named holes at the far end of the room. Severus had unsuccessfully attempted to redirect them to his office many times. So when a knock came on the door at the crack of dawn on a Friday morning, whilst Severus was sorting through pointless memos, he was the only one present to open it.
"Oh, thank Merlin, I thought nobody might be here," said Cedric Diggory.
He was pale as a sheet.
"Sir, you have to come quickly. Something dreadful has happened."
Now there was a Hogwarts champion, Severus thought, as he followed the boy out of the room and up the stairs. Calm and collected in the face of an emergency, retaining enough rationality in spite of shock to speak in coherent sentences, it only proved Severus existing, guarded, silent, liking of him. True, Cedric was disgustingly popular, but unlike Potter, he never carried his fame like a torch. He was modest, hard-working, and always addressed teachers with appropriate deference and respect. It did not hurt, either, that he wasn't half bad at potions. In short, he was one of those select students Severus had gladly welcomed into his NEWT classes. He even had the courtesy to attempt to soften the blow, unaware that Severus was unlikely to feel it. "It's bad," he said as he opened the door to the prefect's bathroom. "I still can't believe." Severus stepped over the threshold. Beside the ornate pool lay Potter, a towel draped over his unclothed body. Checking a pulse was clearly a waste of time. To judge by the rigid clench of Potter's fingers, rigor mortis had long since set in. Severus knelt down, regardless, already looking for clues.
"You found him like this?"
"No," Cedric said. "When I came in for my morning run, he was..." He paused, swallowing heavily, floating. "So I pulled him out, of course, and tried to resuscitate him, but..."
"He'd already drowned," Severus said.
His fingers found a bump at the back of Potter's head. They returned sticky with old blood, diluted by water, and he traced the faint smear of it across the tile. Most of it had been washed off the edge of the tub, but enough remained to determine where Potter's head had struck it.
"If I'd come sooner," Cedric said, "you still would have been too late," Severus said, glancing at him. "Judging by his skin, I'd estimate he died hours ago."
But Cedric did not look relieved, not in the slightest. He was pressing a hand to his mouth, eyes wide and horrified.
"What does interest me," Severus said, trying to recall who the Gryffindor prefect was, "is how Potter came to be in here at all."
Cedric shook his head and heaved a shuddering breath, shutting his eyes. Severus felt strangely compelled to walk over and soothe him, but that was absurd. He waited long seconds, instead, resolved to give the boy some chance of reaching calm.
"This is my fault," Cedric said when he opened his eyes again, tears spilling over his cheeks. I take full responsibility. I gave him the password."
As Severus's mind helplessly flashed to unicorns and rose bushes, any compassion he'd felt a second ago instantly died.
"You are aware," he said quite sharply, "that Potter was 14 years old."
"What?" Cedric said. No, you've got it all wrong. It wasn't like that. It was..." He pointed at something shielded from Severus's view by the corner of the bath. When Severus bent around, he discovered it to be the Triwizard Egg.
"The clue," Cedric said. "I gave him the password so he could figure it out. But I never thought that something like this would happen, or I wouldn't..."
Severus sighed.
"You hardly had cause to," he allowed as he rose to his feet. "Merlin only knows how Potter managed to..."
"I almost forgot," Cedric interrupted him. "When I arrived, he wasn't alone. She disappeared so quickly that I don't think I fully took her in, but..."
"Who?"
"A ghost. That girl, the one with the glasses. Haunts the girl's toilet, I think. What's her name?"
"Moaning Myrtle," Severus said, cursing his rotten luck.
"Yes," Cedric said, and then visibly deflated. "Not that it's going to matter. He's dead, and how am I meant to... I don't think I'll ever be able to forget how he..."
"Oh no," Severus said, hand on his wand already. "You'll forget easily. In fact, all you'll remember is running into Potter during your jog this morning. You'll practically feel compelled to inform the first Gryffindor you meet that he told you he would skip classes to work on the clue. Obliviate."
If Severus reminded himself a little of Lockhart with the number of memory modifications he engaged in these days, then surely that was well within the realms of acceptability. After all, he wasn't interfering with the mind of anyone who'd lived to... not remember it. That was a process he still thoroughly detested. And besides, it was just so much easier to do the necessary research when one did not have to contend with morning students and staff at the same time.
"Go away," said the ghost floating in the girl's bathroom. "I've heard all about you. You're that mean one. You'll only make fun of me," she hiccoughed. "They all do."
"Then perhaps," Severus said, subtly drawing his wand from his cloak, "you had best get it over with quickly, hmm?"
"I don't think so," she said, and took off for the cubicles.
Severus stepped in front of her path before she could get very far, raising his hand.
"I wouldn't do that if I were you, because I can assure you, being as mean as I am fully conversant in spells that can hurt even a ghost."
She hovered uncertainly, her eyes wet and shimmering.
Oh, you're horrible. What have I ever done to deserve this? Poor, mistreated Myrtle, not even safe from the teachers, harassed, victimized at every...
Bullshit, Severus snapped. You know exactly what it is that you have done. Out with it. Potter, what did you do to him?
I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about. How could I, when nobody ever bothers to pay me attention?
Remember those spells? Severus said, flicking his wand so that sparks shot from the end. Nasty ones they are, too, and I am 1 second away from—
It wasn't my fault, said Myrtle. I was only trying to be—
Her gaze turned sly.
Friendly, that's all. A girl does get lonely, you know.
For heaven's sake, what was wrong with this school? Why was everyone around him suddenly obsessed with sex? You tried to molest him?
Oh, how insensitive, Myrtle sobbed. As if I could molest anyone in this state.
She swept a transparent hand through Severus's chest, as if her being incorporeal required demonstration.
I just wanted a little peek, really. He's got such nice eyes, she smiled. And his thighs weren't half bad either, when I watched him undress. Nor was his—
Yes, yes, Severus said hastily. So you watched him get into the tub, and then—
Well, he had his back turned to me, didn't he? So I thought I'd better dive into the water to get a proper look whilst I could.
Severus's lip curled in distaste.
How was I to know he'd recoil and bang his head on the edge? I thought about calling someone at first, but then I figured if he drowned, maybe he'd turn into a ghost too, and I wouldn't have to be on my own anymore. But I waited and waited.
Her eyes filled up again.
For hours I waited, and he didn't turn into a ghost, so I'm still all alone. All the other ghosts shun me, you know.
I cannot imagine why, Severus said.
Myrtle hiccoughed.
There's no need to be cruel. Why can't you be more like him? He was the only one who ever took time to listen to me, and now he's gone too. Oh, this is terrible.
Severus had heard enough. As he turned on his heel and strolled out of the room, Myrtle flung herself over the top of the cubicle walls with a wail, and there was an immense splash, torrents of water flooding the floor. Luckily, Severus had already reached the door.
Contrary to what he'd told the ghost, his spell repertoire did not, in fact, contain a plethora of ghost-repelling spells. He knew the basics, but had never been overly concerned with finding ways of manipulating those already dead. The living were plenty enough to contend with. He most certainly had never come across a spell to deter overly amorous ghosts. Frankly, he doubted whether such a thing existed at all. Had Myrtle been a human being, or a hippogriff, for that matter, the solution would have been obvious. There were a vast number of anti-lust potions and drafts to choose from, each of them easily adapted. But he needed some kind of charm, and for once his encyclopedic knowledge appeared to fail him. Truthfully, he'd found himself so frequently tempted to hex hormonal teenagers into some state of sanity that he decided it was best he remain ignorant of a fast-track route to achieving such. Dumbledore would never have stood for it if he'd accidentally sterilized one of the little beasts. And so the early afternoon found him in the restricted section, selecting a collection of titles which should provide him with the grounding he required. What he had not counted on, however, was running straight into Granger in one of the aisles. Or, more like, Granger running straight into him. "Sorry, sir," she said, and promptly bent down to pick up the books she had knocked out of his hand. Severus's eyes widened in alarm, but he was a fraction too late to prevent the disaster. Granger had already grasped the books and was skimming their spines out of sheer habit. She froze. Her eyes turned wide as saucers, then flickered towards him, horror writ large in every line of her face. She looked as though she desired nothing so much as to sink straight through the floor, or, failing that, spontaneously combust on the spot. Anything to unsee what she had seen. Severus could entirely relate. Flushing crimson, he ripped 100 lust-curbing charms, lull your libido, and worst of all, mastering the urge to perversion from her hands and covered them with his robes, all the while fighting a desperate drive to explain that there was a perfectly innocent explanation.
"Foolish girl," he snapped instead, because he didn't need to justify anything. "Watch where you're going."
He moved to brush past her, but Granger leapt to her feet in the same instant, causing their limbs to get hopelessly entangled in the squashed space between bookshelves. She stumbled, would have fallen if not for her hands instinctively clutching onto his robes. Severus's face burnt even hotter.
"Don't touch me,"
he snarled and pushed her away. Granger squeaked, pressing herself flat against the shelf as he rushed past her and fled from the library as quickly as his feet would allow. The knowledge that she wouldn't remember any of this was a faint consolation on his way to the dungeons. He'd better find a solution in those damn books, and fast, because the last thing he needed was an outraged Minerva knocking on his door to accuse him of accosting her most prized pupil like the worst sort of deviant. Innocent explanation or not, he still felt like the worst sort of deviant as he hovered inside the prefect's bathroom hours later, blending into the wall under a powerful disillusionment spell. But without knowing if the spell he had used on Myrtle had fully taken hold, he'd managed to merge a standard chastity charm with the arithmetic formula underpinning common ghost banishment spells, he could not risk staying away. If the experiment failed, he needed to be there to stop Potter from drowning. He felt all the more like a pervert when Potter finally entered the room. Although Severus caught only the barest flash of skin, looking away the instant the boy began to undress, the rustle of clothes hitting the ground was torture enough. Fixing his gaze to the far wall, he prayed that Potter would never, ever have cause to die naked again, because this was simply not to be borne. Severus did not spy on students. He broke apart courting couples on the astronomy tower and in other secluded spots, certainly, but that was his duty, and the only thrill he got out of it derived squarely from their embarrassment at being discovered in flagrante. If it were up to Severus, none of them would discover such dubious pleasures at all. Myrtle still showed up and still flirted, but to Severus's relief she appeared much subdued. Nevertheless, his skin fairly crawled by the time Potter finally disappeared. The restless urge to move when he couldn't didn't ease his discomfort either. He had just taken his first step in what felt like hours when the ghost who'd zoomed up the tap as Potter left reemerged from it and hovered by the side of the pool.
"He didn't even seem happy to see me," she murmured sadly.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Frozen in stillness, Severus debated whether it would be easier to just blast her with a banishment charm now, but in the end decided against it. He was stuck with this timeline, and no matter how unlikely she was to report it, he did not fancy having to explain why he was lurking in the shadows of bathrooms frequented by students. A good hour must have passed before the coast was clear. By then, having been forced to listen to the ghost's thoroughly aggravating wails of self-pity, Severus was itching with frustration. Matters did not remotely improve when he let himself into his quarters, only for Snape to barge out of the bedroom, wand in hand.
"Oh no, not you," he said, "and here I thought tonight couldn't get much more atrocious than it's already been."
Severus's attempt to glare fell short beneath confusion.
"What do you mean, atrocious?"
As far as he remembered it, he'd slept soundly. Well, as soundly as he ever did. Snape looked equally perplexed.
"You mean you don't know? Potter broke into our office, stealing again, and then I had to contend with Moody harassing me on top of..."
"He did what?" Severus said, anger rising sharply inside him.
"When?" "Just now. Managed to drop that blasted egg of his. The screeching woke me. But of course, by the time I got there, he'd already scarpered beneath his cloak. If it hadn't been for the map, which he also dropped, I might never have known.
Naturally, his mouth twisted in a scowl, Moody covered for him, and, as I had no concrete proof, and he seemed remarkably keen to divulge my past allegiances to Filch, I was forced to retreat.
Severus did not respond. He was too caught up in a boiling wave of hot rage to speak. Once again, he'd saved Potter's life, and this was how Potter chose to repay him.
Bookshelf collapsed on his head, Severus wrote,
and pondered the miracle of Potter actively studying. In spite of his anger, he could not fail to pick up on how the tournament seemed to be wearing on the boy. The signs were simply too plentiful to dismiss, painted all over him in lurid colors, from the ever-darkening circles beneath his eyes to the nervous drum of his fingers against a table, from the yawns and perpetual distraction to the increasing number of meals during which Severus observed him eating not so much as a scrap. In his quieter moments, Severus thought of Dumbledore's words earlier in the year, and wondered if maybe there was not some truth to them, if Potter had been just as forced into this farce as Severus himself. In his quieter moments, when he wasn't watching the wider signs of this tale coalesce in darkness through hints in the newspapers, when he wasn't busy warning Dumbledore and making plans for the worst, he sometimes chastised himself for being so harsh. Whilst Potter died during the second task, as Severus expected, solving it was no hardship. All he needed was a last push propelling him toward the surface of the water. That night, Severus lay awake, thinking of Potter's refusal to leave the other hostages, and wondering if maybe, just maybe, it was not glory that drove him, but something far more dangerous, something a little like compassion. He fell asleep only to dream uneasy dreams full of green eyes, and, for the first time, they featured not a strand of red hair. Whatever his private contemplations of Potter, they seemed to vanish the moment he came face to face with the boy, as though the lack of physical distance shattered the fragile spell that held them aloft, allowed them to exist at all. The moment Potter glared at him, as he did routinely, as though it came as naturally as breathing, something inside Severus snapped, and he saw the truth of it all. Then he cursed himself a billion times a fool for ever daring to think otherwise, for not seeing the obvious. The dark circles and yawns only attested to Potter's exploits. Clearly he considered himself above bedtime rules. The distraction and finger-tapping rested in boredom and arrogance, not nerves or agitation. Evidently, potions was not entertaining enough to keep him enthralled. And as for the lack of dinners, well, it must be that Potter was vain enough to dread putting on a few pounds. Lockhart, too, had skipped meals from time to time, overly concerned with appearing thin and svelte for the inevitable newspaper spreads. Early March proved that, once and for all, with which weekly spreads on Potter's lap during class. Severus took great delight in reading the article as it ought to be read, emphasizing each mock-worthy note, each overwrought passage. Potter needed to learn that fame equaled nothing but hypocrisy, and that such articles weren't worth the paper they were printed on. That he reacted to being separated from his two biggest fans by sulkily bashing valuable ingredients about only spurred Severus on.
"All this press attention seems to have inflated your already overlarge head, Potter," he said.
Potter refused to look at him, ashamed, most likely, which meant that the lesson was beginning to sink in.
"You might be laboring under the delusion that the entire wizarding world is impressed with you," Severus said quietly.
The boy continued pounding his scarab beetles, though they had long since passed the threshold of being useful for the potion.
"But I don't care how many times your picture appears in the papers. To me, Potter, you are nothing but a nasty little boy who considers rules to be beneath him."
Potter started chopping his ginger roots, extremely messily, hand-shaking. Perhaps not shame after all, then, but anger. Frankly, Severus no longer cared.
He thought of everything that Potter had put him through, and some part of him thrilled darkly at the chance to repay him. Within reason, of course.
"So I give you fair warning, Potter," he said, "pint-sized celebrity or not. If I catch you breaking into my office one more time..."
"I haven't been anywhere near your office," Potter burst out, glaring hotly.
"Don't lie to me," Severus said. "Boomslangskin, Gillyweed, both come from my private stores, and I know who stole them."
No, no shame at all. Judging by the way Potter was staring at him, he probably never heard the word. "I don't know what you're talking about," he lied, not even blinking. And to think that Severus had almost begun to feel something like concern for him. Outrageous.
"You were out of bed the night my office was broken into," he said. "I know it, Potter. Now, Mad-Eye Moody might have joined your little fan club, but I will not tolerate your behavior. One more nighttime stroll into my office, Potter, and you will pay."
"Right," Potter said, turning back to his ginger roots as though he had the power, the authority, to dismiss Severus just because he fancied it so. "I'll bear that in mind if I ever get the urge to go in there." For a moment, Severus saw red. For a moment, he was one instant away from reaching out and strangling the little pest with bare hands. But no, that would be unwise. He'd only have to go back and have an aggravating chat with himself. He plunged his hands into his robes instead, rooting around for the vial he had begun to carry as a precaution lately.
"Do you know what this is, Potter?" he said, holding it up.
"No," said Potter.
"It is Veritaserum, a truth potion so powerful that 3 drops would have you spilling your innermost secrets for this entire class to hear."
And oh, wouldn't that be lovely? Potter, stripped, not of clothes, but of pretense, exposed.
"Now, the use of this potion is controlled by very strict guidelines, but unless you watch your step, you might just find that my hand slips."
He shook the vial slightly.
"Right over your evening pumpkin juice. And then, Potter, then we'll find out whether you've been in my office or not."
Potter said nothing, but his silence spoke volumes. Severus watched as he pretended to return his focus to brewing, watched fear creep into his features, outright panic almost, and for long moments he soared on top of the world. If nothing else, he could still get under Potter's skin, and although it hardly made up for the nightmares and everything else, the knowledge took some of the sting from the experiences Severus had fought with all year. A few further well-placed remarks during this class, and he might almost reach some sort of balance. He sat, planning them out in great detail, weighing each line and its delivery for the best impact. And then Karkaroff came and forcibly burst his bubble, because in Severus's life, not even the petty pleasures had the decency to last.
"Swallowed a bug which turned out to be Rita Skeeter in unlicensed animagus form, who transformed out of panic and promptly ripped him apart from the inside," Severus wrote.
He found no joy in the words, when surely he ought to have done. As deaths went, it was completely absurd, and, moreover, provided him with outstanding blackmail material should he ever require it in future. True, the sight had been unpleasant, but he considered himself inured to such inconsequentialities. That he dreamed of them at times was beside the point. It had been the only death in almost 3 months. Each day, the mark on his arm sharpened further. Potter keeled over in divination, clutching his scar, and Severus's dreams increasingly filled with red eyes. Bertha Jorkins remained missing, and Crouch... who knew what had happened to Crouch? If only Severus had not been so quick to dismiss Potter when he tried to gain entrance to the headmaster's office. If only, if only. The date for the third task was rapidly approaching. June 24th arrived. At breakfast, Severus found himself lacking in appetite. Somehow, he equally found no taste for the article defaming Potter in The Prophet. As he set the paper down, he felt only regret at not handing Skeeter in when given the chance. Strange, the effect worry could have on one's perceptions. All day he invigilated exams, but his mind refused to stay on task. By the time evening rolled around and the crowds began to swell, every muscle in his body seemed to vibrate with tension.
"What do you mean I won't be patrolling the maze? You can't simply relegate me to the stands."
"I am afraid Alastor protested your unsuitability to Ludo Bagman himself," Dumbledore said, sounding regretful. "It is out of my hands."
He grasped Severus lightly by the elbow.
"Come, sit with me."
"Don't," Severus said, without knowing fully where the words came from. "Don't let him walk in there, please. I have a terrible feeling about all this."
Dumbledore studied him closely, frowning.
"Do you have any further knowledge that I remain unaware of?"
"No," Severus said. "It's merely..."
He broke off, shaking his head. It was merely a feeling. Feelings, he reminded himself, were not fact.
"You know that I share your concern, but I cannot call the tournament off without good reason. Come," Dumbledore repeated, "sit with me."
As spectator sports went, watching an impenetrable maze ought to have been resoundingly dull, but his trepidation kept Severus spellbound. Eons trickled by, slow as molasses. When red sparks shot over the top of the hedge, Severus jerked. Dumbledore rested a hand on his arm.
"It will be attended to."
Severus nodded, but felt no relief until at long last Minerva appeared in the distance, floating a body before her.
"It's Crumb!"
shouted a witch with omnioculars three rows down, and Severus collapsed back in his seat. Mere seconds later, he felt it. He grabbed Dumbledore's arm, his fingers not resting lightly as the headmaster's had done, but digging in, clutching convulsively.
"Did you not—"
Dumbledore broke off the moment he caught sight of Severus's face. Or so Severus presumed. He could not see much through the dizziness which shook him.
"No,"
he said, just one little word, but it was enough. Prying Severus's fingers loose, Dumbledore rose. To an outside observer, he would have looked perfectly calm, Severus thought, as he fought the urge to claw at his own arm.
"Stay here," Dumbledore said, and smoothly exited the box. For long moments, Severus sat, frozen.
All around him, people were talking in hushed, excited whispers and murmurs, but their voices seemed to echo from far, far away, through the dull roar of blood in his own ears.
"No," he thought, "no."
He had forgotten how much it hurt, as though his skin was being flayed to the bone. He had forgotten the pull, how much it felt like a yearning, so darkly bittersweet. No, no, this could not be happening. What was he doing, just sitting here? It didn't feel real. Perhaps it wasn't. Maybe he'd finally cracked. With the strain he'd been under lately, it did not seem so absurd. He rose to his feet and slid past faces that blurred, out of the box, down the stairs. In the shadows beneath the stands, he took in a sliver of light, lifted his sleeve with trembling hands. It leered back at him, black, 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 burning. He dropped his sleeve and shook, and his body chose that moment to repay him for not eating all day. In the cover of darkness, he heaved and he heaved and he heaved. He needed to get a grip on himself. It was real, but he could not let it touch him. He could do this. He had to. He'd done it before. He emerged from the stands at the very moment that Potter slammed to the ground, cup in hand, bleeding, clinging to Cedric, who stared at the sky with dead eyes. In the ensuing pandemonium, people leapt over the ground-level boxes, and Severus got lost in the crowd. By the time he had fought his way out, Potter was nowhere to be seen.
"Who took Potter?" he yelled.
He raced towards the castle beside Minerva and the headmaster. He watched Dumbledore blast Moody across the room. He fetched the Veritaserum. He listened to the tale of Barty Crouch, Jr. In the first quiet moment, whilst Potter was being wrapped up and tended to, he stood in the corner of the infirmary and gazed helplessly at the golden hourglass in his hand. Dumbledore came to a halt at his side. For long seconds, he watched Severus in silence.
"It was always going to happen," he said. "We both knew we were living on borrowed time."
Severus swallowed.
At least this way, we know that the boys survived, Dumbledore said.
Yes, Severus said, very quietly. He closed his hand.
You know what is needed, Dumbledore said. It will be soon. Prepare yourself.
Severus nodded. He reached over and grasped Dumbledore's hand. The time turner clinked softly as he dropped it into his palm.
You had best keep hold of this, he said. Chances are I shan't be successful. We cannot risk it falling into his hands.
Dumbledore grasped his chin, tilting Severus's head toward him. His eyes were blue, so very, very blue.
I shall keep it safe, he said, until you return. Severus, Dumbledore said, you know what I must ask you to do. If you are ready, if you are prepared.
I am, Severus said.
Then good luck, Dumbledore said.
Severus turned away from him and from Potter and headed for his death. He walked through Hogwarts' darkened grounds. The night air was chill. He did not feel it. He walked up the stairs. His fingers trembled. He did not feel that, either.
Sugar Pops, he said.
He did not knock on the door. Dumbledore, sitting behind his desk, looked up as he entered, relief blooming on every line of his face. Severus felt that, least of all.
My boy, you are a sight for sore eyes, Dumbledore said, rising. Sit, sit.
Severus sat.
He was not pleased, he said.
But he believed you.
I am here, am I not?
Dumbledore studied him with a deep frown. Severus had not glanced at a mirror, but he knew what he would see.
Perhaps you ought to go see Poppy before we—
I am fine.
At least, Dumbledore said, already halfway around the desk, let me heal you.
A high note issued down from the ceiling. With a flutter of wings, the phoenix descended, landing on Severus's shoulder. Softly, it began to sing. Severus closed his eyes and did not cry.
I ask much of you, Dumbledore murmured, running his wand along the gash on the side of his face.
You ask what is necessary, Severus said,
and tried to believe it. That night, at the leaving feast, he sat at the high table and observed the subdued crowds. He stared at the empty space at the Hufflepuff table and thought of Cedric Diggory, of his diligently crafted essays and easy smile, of his well-thought-out, insightful questions in class. Thank you, sir, his last words to Severus had been. I've learned a lot from you. Severus had given a curt nod in reply. When he glanced over at the Gryffindor table, Potter was watching him. There was no hatred in his green eyes, but a flatness, as though they had forgotten how to burn. His face was pale, his features unmoving, reflecting the same unnatural coldness that Severus felt clinging to every inch of himself like a veil. He held Potter's gaze, acutely aware of the whispers, the hurried, suspicious glances blanketing him from the sidelines, and thought that whatever Potter had done, he did not, would never, deserve this. He looked away.